and welcome to the unreleased The Design Research Podcast. This podcast exists to help map, broadcast, and promote design research worldwide. The unreleased podcast is brought to you by IAD, Universidade Europeia, and UNIDCOM. The interview was recorded at IAD as part of the PhD in Design program. To know more, visit unreleased.unidcom-iad.pt. That's .unidcom-iad.pt. In this episode, recording during the 2020 Doctoral Design Consortium, David Antonio Gambera talks with Geke Luden, Associate Professor at University of Twente and Head of the Interaction Design Chair at the Department of Design, Production and Management. Luden is also a fellow of the Design Lab and an editor of the Journal of Design Research. Her research studies are on how the design of products and services influences people's behavior and motivation, with a specific interest in how products and services can support healthy behavior and in how technology, interactive devices, and wearables can engage people in the therapy at home. Luden is co-editor of the book Design for Behavior Change, published by Ashgate, and her research is organized in larger and smaller projects, many of which are collaborations with researchers from other disciplines, health, computer science, etc., and with industry and public partners, including Philips, Vital Minds, Zorgrøn St. Martin, Demens. During this conversation, Luden talks about the intrinsic technology and behavior monitoring, transdisciplinary design to promote behavior change. All this topic is dealt within the University of Twente.
Design always influences behavior, and in some of my talks, I also often also use the example of how a simple thing like the design of an ear on a cup can already influence your behavior. If it's a big ear, you will hold it very firmly. If it's a very delicate ear, you will hold it very gently. So design always influences people's behavior, and we're just becoming more aware of it. And while we are becoming more aware of it, we're also trying to put this to good use, and we're trying to become more responsible in the things that we design.
Here are David and Luden.
Thank you for accepting our great invitation with great kindness to participate to our design consortium and also to our podcast Unreleased. I want to start with you talking about your research field. So nowadays we see behavioral change as a frequent topic in design conferences and journals. It became really central in the last years, in the last 10 years. And how would you explain this great success?
That's actually a very difficult question, Davide. Why is it such a big success? Maybe just to explain this a bit, I started working on design for behavior change. Let me think back. I think about 11 years ago, 11 or 12 years ago. So then at that time, I think it was sort of starting to become more popular as a topic to work on. But if you think about it, designers have always been influencing behavior in everything that they design, not only since the last 10 or 12 years or a bit before that. Design always influences behavior. And in some of my talks, I often also use the example of how a simple thing like the design of an ear on a cup can already influence your behavior. If it's a big ear, you will hold it very firmly. If it's a very delicate ear, you will hold it very gently. So design always influences people's behavior, and we're just becoming more aware of it. And while we are becoming more aware of it, we're also trying to put this to good use, and we're trying to become more responsible in the things that we design and how we then influence people's behavior. And that whole development has been going on for much longer. And I think that the more recent developments are geared towards many areas also had. So in energy consumption, in health behavior. And that's also because we face large challenges there. So we really need to take this responsibility as designers.
When I saw the topic of the presentation, I thought, and I said this also in the presentation, that was a really actual topic, because now we are facing a pandemic. The COVID-19 changed our life a lot in the last months. But we saw in this moment more than previously that design of a behavior. Changing the behavior through design could be, and actually it was, a good strategy to reduce to delay the pandemic and reduce the pressure on intensive care units, for example. Some researchers suggest that we should use HAP for controlling our movements and prevent the contagion. Do you think that the technology nowadays is the best way to promote healthy behavior, or there are other options?
Yeah, there are other options, but I think that technology can definitely help, and not only because technology is omnipresent and can has all these options to monitor and to provide information to people, but also because people are quite used to using information that they gain from their technology. We're quite used to quickly looking things up on our mobile phone if we want to have information about something, and it can also act very reassuring. At the same time, obviously, there are large concerns about using technology that is omnipresent and that is monitoring people all the time. So for me, it would always be a combination between using this personal technology that we use to gather information and also to provide others with our information, with design in the actual environment, because we already know that just using the personal technology isn't actually very helpful in changing people's behavior. So I would always argue for a combination of using technology and using a different design in an environment. And you already also see this happening. I'm not sure about how things are in Portugal, in Lisbon at the moment. But here in the Netherlands, we see, for example, that in stores, we have lines that are 1.5 meters apart so that people have a better understanding of what a distance is, an appropriate distance to another person is. What you also see in parks are these circles that people can use to sit in. And I think that all those sorts of interventions, those type of designs that are actually in our environment, making us aware of what the appropriate behavior is, are far more effective than having a tracing app and having people rely on information that's hidden inside their mobile phones.
You mentioned during your amazing talk the word engagement, and I think that is a good way to engage people. Also, because sometimes when we are just talking about technology, we see that there are many concerns by several people. We saw during the COVID-19 pandemic that in front of the development of some apps made to control the pandemic, some people had some concerns about data protection. On the other side, when an app or a specific design creates engagement, we don't think so much about the topics about data protection. We think about how fun it is to use a specific service. So is it engagement a way to overcome those concerns, those obstacles that people have somehow?
I don't think it should be, actually. It may be used in that way. People may try even to use it in this way to get more people to use a certain application and not be too worried about the concerns that come from using or with using the application. But I don't think we should use it in that way. If we want to be, and if we truly and honestly want people to engage with the situation, which is more the macro engagement that I was talking about in my talk just now, so not just the engagement with the technology, but the engagement with the issue that we're addressing together, so in this case, the pandemic that we are in and trying to prevent more disaster than we have already seen, then we should be very transparent in what we do and not focus on engagement with technology in order to become less transparent. And I think that's really comes with being a responsible designer, being transparent about what you do and not trying to make using a technology so engaging that it's unclear for people what's actually happening.
In the case of health, when we talk about health, is it always nice, I think, to remember the definition of health proposed by the World Health Organization when they say that it's a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being and not merely the absence of a disease and infirmity. In this case, we saw your work and we saw how you successfully addressed topics, for example, mental health, social problems, as part of a unique process. Do nowadays social and mental problems have the same weight of physical problems in the field of design for health?
Do they have the same weight? Are they equally important, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, first of all, the definition. I often ask my students when we talk about this, talk about health and behavior change for health, I often explain this definition to my students and ask them, who feels healthy, completely healthy? And then maybe there's one or two people raising their hand, and you probably know this, but there's quite some discussion around this definition. So it's hardly possible to be completely healthy, both mentally and physically all the time. And I think that definition, well, I think there's already some proposals to change it, and that's good, I think. And your about the second part of your question, if mental health is becoming increasingly important or equally weighted as physical health, I think more and more so. And maybe that's also because we see what I talked about before, this this increase in mental diseases and for example, anxiety and depression. There are huge increases for people in facing these problems. So I think it's becoming increasingly important because more people have to deal with it, but also maybe because we become less afraid of it, and we see it as maybe equally important to be mentally healthy as to be physically healthy. There's an increasing importance to how we can develop as a person, as an individual, and for that you need to be not only healthy, but you need to have resilience, right? Which is a very important topic in positive psychology, the psychology that studies not only the illnesses within mental health, but also how people feel better and are happier and are more resilient. And I think that's becoming increasingly important. So that's a huge development in that field that probably makes people more aware of it, makes it a bit more normal to talk about mental health. And that makes it then, I think equally important as physical health.
Sometimes it's still considered in a wrong way in the society. Mental health are somehow hidden by the people that actually suffer those kind of pathologies, and maybe it is a comfortable, engaged, playful design can help us somehow to overcome those kind of obstacles.
Yeah.
Maybe design has a great advantage in this in this sense, because as designers we always collaborate with medical sciences, with the psychology, with several disciplines that participate to the design process of the final solution. So we are able to connect knowledges of different areas. So this refers to the topic of the design consortium, transdisciplinarity. So how transdisciplinary approaches are so fundamental in design for promoting behavioral change?
Yeah, especially in the health and well-being domain, as you mentioned, because the challenges that are there are just not challenges that belong to one domain, to one science. And design can definitely have a contribution and enable this step from having the technology that we can use to monitor our behavior, to give us feedback, to also actually supporting people and making the transition towards a behavior change in a pleasant and maintainable way. And in care, even more so, because as I just explained about one of our projects, the wearable breathing trainer, which is a garment that helps children to adopt a better breathing pattern. This is really something that we cannot do with designers alone. We need to have people involved who are pulmonary pediatricians who know a lot about breathing, who know breathing patterns, who know we need people who know how to use the appropriate sensor technology that can measure the breathing patterns. And then we need the pulmonary pediatricians to understand these breathing patterns. So we really have to have this combination of disciplines. It's the only way that we can design for this type of behavior change in therapy. And I think that goes not only for this example, but almost for every behavior change project in health and care.
Maybe governmental entities can with more and more research done in this field can be more aware nowadays, especially in the specific historic period, about the importance of having design as a engine for setting successful strategies in health. I'm going to take some questions now from the audience that I'm receiving here. Mm-hmm. So the first question is, what modification, if any, should we make in our course curricula? It's about education, to prepare and motivate our design students to work on these topics.
Yeah, good question. Well, the first question is whether every designer should maybe be actively involved with this topic. The way we organize it now at our university is that we have, in our master, we have different tracks. So designers tend to choose one of the tracks. And we have one track that's called Human Technology Relations. And in this Human Technology Relations track, there are several courses more to do with behavior. I think that all designers should understand how behavior is brought about, because it's always related to what you design, how it influences behavior. But really, behavior change and knowing and understanding theories around behavior change, knowing how to work with different strategies for behavior change, for me, that's sort of a speciality that not every designer has to be able to, has to be skilled in. So we have a course in design and behavior change that at least all the students in this track have to follow, but it's also open to other programs. So everybody at the University of Twente who is interested in following such a course can participate. And then we make multidisciplinary teams, because we think it's already important that the students who work on this topic also learn to work with the different disciplines. So we have students in communication sciences, we have students in interaction technology, students in industrial design engineering, and they together work on a behavior change challenge. For this year, maybe it's nice to just share this with you. All of the groups chose to work on a challenge related to the COVID pandemic, because they were so caught up in this pandemic. They really felt the urge to tackle some of the challenges that come with it. And that was really nice to see. So yeah, should we do this in all curriculums? Maybe not. But if we do, I would suggest to at least also make it a multidisciplinary effort, if it's possible.
This is a good topic now to open another window that is about ethical topics. I received a question from the audience. They say, for years, designers have worked hard to promote some behaviors that now turned out to be dangerous. Mm. What ethical implications should design assume when they decide to promote a given behavior?
Yeah, very good question. And it's also something that we try to practice with our students in the design and behavior change course, for example, because you're absolutely right. And what we try to do is have our students look at a specific topic that they're working on or a solution that they have designed for that topic, to look at that solution from different angles and different perspectives. And the best way to do that is to actively involve other people beyond the project team into this development and ask them for their opinion and for their views, because that may change the way you look at it. But we also try in smaller teams, we try this out. Can you take a different perspective? What if you look at it this way? What if you look at it in the long term? And recently there is also increasing attention, and I think that designers should pay attention to this development in making use of methodology that can help designers to see the consequences of what they design in the future and help them to adopt these different perspectives that I was talking about. These are developing methods now in value-sensitive design, trying to understand what values underlie a certain development and how your design maybe changes the values or adheres to the values or not adheres to the values. That's one of them. And then there are other methods that you can use that are out there to really study the implications of what you are designing.
So maybe if we think about the education in design, let's say involving students in practices in design, something that could generate a positive behavioral change, is also a kind of training for them to be in the future more conscious, or using a term that you mentioned in your presentation, a responsible designer. Sometimes in the traditional paradigm of design, we didn't see so much responsible designer, and we saw that some design solution creates some negative implication. Mm. So as we can see, ethics are really, really important. Also to decide which kind of, if the solution that we are going to implement in society is truly positive or not. In your opinion, how can we know which kind of tools or methodology, or apart from our personal sensibility, can we use to understand if we are addressing the right problem or if we are proposing the correct behavior?
Well, some of the tools that I mentioned before, so value-sensitive design methodology, which is a methodology that comes from the domain of philosophy of technology, and it's, in my opinion, still not very not a very actionable methodology for designers, but I know that several design research groups are working on refinement of such methodologies. Another one, a tool that's also described in the book Design and Behavior Change, Design for Behavior Change, is the Product Impact Tool. It's a really nice tool with a web environment where you can do this perspective taking and make a full study out of this. And another thing I would add is we can, as designers, become more skilled in doing this and thinking through implications of our work. But it's also something that people in philosophy of technology are very skilled in. So another solution would be to add those to your those people or one of those people to your project team.
Okay, let's take another question from the audience. We are receiving several questions. So can you explain the influence that nudge theory has in your work and how you can tackle the problem of scalability of results that certain effects might be seen as an individual level but would be harder to replicate at a broader societal level? Oh, really specific question.
Yeah, so nudge theory is obviously one of the most famous theories in behavior change, I would say. And what we have to realize is that using these nudges often is very helpful if you want to influence behavior in a not so conscious way. So nudging people towards staying at an appropriate distance, for example, with a line is perfectly fine for me, but it doesn't really help people to be aware of why they are doing something and to do it again if maybe they don't have this actual nudge in their environment. So for me, it's one of the tools, one of the strategies that's out there in behavior change theory. And then the problem of scalability of results. So effects at an individual level, but harder to replicate at a broader societal level. I think that's absolutely still an open question. And we're only just starting to understand how we need to design for behavior change at a social or societal level.
I think that when we talk about design for behavioral change, in for us that are engaged in the design research, we know the importance of this specific topic for health and for well-being. But sometimes in the market, we see that some companies are not still aware about the importance of doing research in this field. Mm-hmm. Why do you think this happened, and how can we bridge this gap between designers, design for behavioral change, and companies?
That's a nice question. The answer lies, I think, in collaboration and communication, obviously, because it's, and it is, by the way, we did a study a few years ago already to see how indeed the industry understands and knows about behavioral theory, behavioral change theory, and strategies for behavior change. And you're right that some of them did indeed not know about it or understand what they could do with it. Like I said, it's really about collaborating then with them and communicating about the effective results that we see from some of the efforts that maybe have been done with other companies. And it also depends on the company. We've been talking about in the project that I showed before, the 40U Pride and Prejudice project, which is a very large consortium where also industry partners are involved. Some companies are very eager to be at the forefront of what is happening in this field, and that's very good. And in my opinion, other companies will follow if they see the results of that. And for some companies, it may be a bit frightening to talk about behavior change in lifestyle, for example. Maybe when we talk about companies in nutrition and how they might change their products so that people can eat more easily, adopt a healthier lifestyle. It's not always the direct strategy that they go for. They first have to be sure that this is still a promising strategy for them to follow. But I think that we can show that, and then more companies will follow.
Probably when in case of companies, there are some opposite objectives, so the economical return and the metrics in terms of social responsibility, for example. But I think that maybe the education of educating people to a positive, healthy, responsible behavior, not only at the academic level, but also at primary school, at secondary school, could make us responsible for designing maybe a society where future entrepreneurs will be aware about this, great behavioral change. And so maybe it's a long-term objective that we all together need to achieve.
I think it is, because it really also depends a lot on how we can design our complete environment in a way that this is a sustainable and maintainable behavior for many people. And we can only do that if we see large changes where policy is involved, where industry is involved, and where designers and other disciplines are involved.
And taking the opportunity that you are giving now to me with this about sustainability, and we saw, for example, that behavioral change is a strategy used in sustainability, is for sure it's used in health, it's used in those topics that are more close to this design. But this strategy could be applied in other fields, as for example, education, we just mentioned, or politics. What do you think?
Some behavior fields, change techniques, you mean?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Oh, they can be used in many different fields, also beyond sustainability and health and absolutely. And there's a whole field that studies this. The behavioral sciences study how people are influenced generally by other people in different situations. So, but design for behavior change specifically, well, we know it's already also used in design against crime, for example, in safety. And there must be more fields where it's applicable. Education is also a good example. Yeah.
Some other question from the public. Design for behavior change is not fully recognized, neither fully understood. Do you have any tips of how we could make stronger? For instance, how important could be to have better metrics, so the so-called KPLS?
KPLS.
KPIs, probably.
KPIs.
Okay, KPIs.
Maybe.
Okay. Yes,
key
yes.
Performance indicators. So it's not fully understood. And the question is, how can we have better metrics to maybe, for example, study how effective a design for behavior change intervention is? That's absolutely something that we need to develop more. And the problem also often is that it's really difficult to isolate the features in a design that are responsible for a certain behavior change. That's always a challenge in design research, I would say. And maybe the people who were listening before remember that I was talking about this concept of engagement. It's also a concept that we want to make measurable. Building new tools to measure engagement, but also building or designing very rigorous experiments where we manipulate certain features of a design to see how it influences engagement within a therapy, for example. And I think the same you could do for behavior change, because design for behavior change is now a field where many different tools are being tried, many different strategies are being tried, but it's still quite difficult to actually pinpoint what specific strategy works best in what situation and how do we implement it into a design. And for that, to better understand that, we just need more and more cases and more experimental design that is organized in a sufficiently rigorous way. It's always very difficult to completely rigorously design an experiment where you work with different design features, but we can do better than we're doing now.
The audience is talking about Stigmergy, behavioral
yeah.
change. Are you familiar with Stigmergy?
I'm not.
They say it's
interesting to read.
It's a behavioral change phenomenon which can be described as uncoordinated communication. A trace left by an individual is followed and transformed by another individual, originating a new mark. It's mostly what we said when we talked about education some minutes ago, that we have to be a good example if we want to be effective in promoting positive behaviors. We have to be good examples beyond giving technical information. Okay, Professor. Thank you for this beautiful and interesting and inspiring talk. I think that this content will inspire, and I hope it will inspire a lot of students and a lot of people that want to research and bring their practice toward the field of design for a healthy and, let's say, responsible and positive behavioral change. This is the purpose of our release, to inspire them. Thank you so much for your beautiful talk and for this wonderful interview.
Thank you very much, Davide, for the interesting discussion. I enjoyed it a lot. And thank you, all of you, for your inspiring questions. And I will look up Stigmergy. I'm really curious to find out more about it. Thank you so much.
If you like what you heard today, please subscribe to our podcast on the main platform. For more information about the unreleased podcast, go to unreleased.unitcom-yad.pt. There, you can find all the episodes and more information about our guests. Unreleased Podcast is the result of the work of the Students of Design Culture and Practices course from the PhD in Design program of IAD, Universidade Europeia. It's produced and edited by UNITCOM.